What comments do you have regarding the Reverend Ben Chavis and the Wilmington 10 and their charges of political imprisonment?
Well, the only comment that I am free to make under our own system of government is that I hope that justice will prevail, that the ones who are accused of a crime will be given a fair trial. If they are found guilty, that they will be punished in accordance with normal procedures for an equivalent crime committed. There is a very strict prohibition, as you know, against the encroachment of the executive branch of government on the judicial branch. The Attorney General is concerned about this particular case, in that he wants the same thing I want, and that is that justice be done. This has been a matter of long-standing controversy, both on the domestic scene and internationally as well. And I trust the system in its entirety. If there ever is a mistake made at a lower level in our judicial system, there's always a right to appeal. And I believe that the history of our judicial system is that ultimately they make the right decision. But I'm not trying to evade the question. I think that it would be improper for me to try to impose what I think should be a judgment in a case that I've not heard tried. I don't have any direct familiarity with the evidence. I believe that justice will prevail.
President, when you unveiled this energy program to the American people, you said that the alternative to your proposals might be a national catastrophe. Yes. And I want to know exactly what proposals you had in mind. If you lose the standby gas tax, you lose the rebates on fuel-efficient automobiles, if you should lose the deregulation of new natural gas, are those the ones that you had in mind? Or is it the wellhead tax and the coal conversion that you really think are the heart of your program?
I don't think you could single out any one particular point and equate it with a national catastrophe. But unless we take action to meet the goals that we've established, a reduction in overall oil consumption, a reduction in the excessive consumption of natural gas, a shifting toward increased consumption of coal, and an equitable means of pricing oil and gas to encourage additional exploration on the one hand and to protect the interest of consumers on another, those cumulative effects of not meeting these goals would be catastrophic. We now see a rapid escalation in consumption of gasoline. I think this summer we will see the highest use of gasoline in the history of our country. Imports are growing by leaps and bounds. Our trade balance, negative trade balance, is going to be very excessive this year, $25 billion. We'll probably possibly import $45 billion worth of oil. And unless we reverse these present trends by strict conservation brought about by voluntary means, by pricing structures, by tax incentives, the cumulative effect of this absence of adequate leadership on the part of me in Congress will be catastrophic. But each individual component part of this complete plan can't be equated with catastrophe. I might say that we don't consider ourselves to be infallible. Over the 3 or 4 months that we considered this plan before it was presented to the Congress, there were a lot of differences of opinion. Some of the judgments made were quite closely called ones, and the Congress is now finding an equal difficulty in dealing with this controversial issue. So I don't say that everything we propose has got to be passed just as though we put it forward. But I think cumulatively, if we don't take strong and active action, the economic and political consequences will be catastrophic.
Senator Byrd, Saturday, when he made his comments and suggested that maybe you should cool it with the rhetoric, suggested that one reason that you didn't have a very good showing on Capitol Hill last week was because of the ineffectiveness of your own lobbying organization. So I would like to ask you, do you plan to beat that up, or are you planning some sort of new strategy? You say the public has to be aroused. What do you plan to do from here on out about this? Perhaps you'll make some compromises with Congress on other issues, for example.
I think that our efforts have been adequate. I noticed that one of the comments from a congressional leader, I've forgotten which one it was, in response to my criticism of the oil and the automobile lobbies, was that the most effective lobby on Capitol Hill was the one from the White House. I think we are presenting our views to the members of the Congress in an adequate fashion. The agenda for the Congress this year is extraordinarily complex and diverse, not only in ethics legislation, reorganization, legislation, the construction of a new Department of Energy, energy policy, Social Security, but also many things concerning air pollution standards, welfare reform to come. And I believe that that our presentation of our views in a forceful and fair and objective way to the Congress through my own congressional relations group is adequate. I'm proud of them. And I think the differences of opinion that arise between the Congress and myself are not caused by a failure to present ideas. It's just a result of an honest difference of opinion about what ought to be done about these controversial issues. Yes, I promised...
Mr. President, you were attacked rather savagely in the Soviet press last week as James Carter, an enemy of detente. From your vantage point, do you feel there can be any U.S.-Soviet detente without respect for observance of human rights on their part?
Well, obviously the differences that arise between us and the Soviet Union are the things that are highly publicized. I'm grateful to know that... That we are beginning this week to work closely with the Soviet Union on a comprehensive test ban treaty to prohibit all testing of nuclear devices underground or in the atmosphere. They have suggested, along with us, that Great Britain join this negotiation. That's a step in the right direction. Paul Wernicke will begin to negotiate with the Soviet Union within the next week on demilitarization of the Indian Ocean. Again, a very major step forward if completed. There are continuing discussions between ourselves and the Soviet Union on details of the overall SALT agreement. And as I've announced earlier, the Secretary of State and the Soviet foreign ministers will meet at least twice more between now and the expiration date for the present agreement. So I think that in general, we're moving in the right direction. Our statements concerning human rights, I think, have been well received around the world. We've not singled out the Soviet Union for criticism, and I've never tried to inject myself into the internal affairs of the Soviet Union. I've never made the first comment that personally I criticized General Secretary Brezhnev. But when we pursue aggressively and with determination our commitment to the principle that human beings ought to be well treated by governments, that human freedom is one of the highest aspirations and commitments of our country, I think this is the right thing to do. If it hits ourselves as self-criticism, so be it. If it touches the Soviet Union and they interpret it as intrusion, so be it. But we've tried to make this a broad-based approach. I think it's hard to assess the results of this deep commitment, which I think is compatible with the inclinations of the American people. But I don't believe that there is a single leader of a nation on earth today who doesn't have within his or her consciousness a concern about human rights. How do we appear to our own people? How do we appear to observers from other nations? And as we approach very quickly now the preparation for the Belgrade conference to assess the Helsinki progress. That'll take place next October. I think there's a general sense in the world we'd better get our own houses in order. We'd better make a good image available to the outside world, and the scrutiny that's focused on this issue is constructive. And I think that the Soviets' reaction against me personally on the human rights issue is a misplaced aim. I have no hatred for the Soviet people, and I believe that the pressure of world opinion might be making itself felt on them, and perhaps I'm kind of a scapegoat for that adverse reaction on their part. But I feel very deeply that we ought to pursue aggressively this commitment, and I have no second thoughts or hesitation about it. Yes, sir.
UN Ambassador Andrew Young continues to make headlines with his comments about racism.
Yes,
do you think his words have opened old wounds at home and damaged our interests abroad? Or do you welcome this discussion on the nature of racism that he's touched on?
I think the statements that Andy Young has made are different from what I would have said. The word racism has different connotations to different people, as does the phrase human rights. I think In almost every instance when Andy has said something that was criticized, if someone read the entire text, how he defined racism, there is no criticism involved. But when you extract the one word, it implies a much heavier condemnation than Ambassador Young meant. I read the transcript of his comments about former Presidents Nixon and Ford. He explained that when he used the word racism as it applied to them, that it was not a condemnation, but it was an assessment that they were not familiar with the special problems of black people or minority groups who did not have an opportunity to be vivid in their own consciousness as former presidents. I think that in general, what Ambassador Young is accomplishing for us in dealing with third world nations, those who are struggling for recognition, those who are struggling against oppressive hunger and disease and poverty, is very good. They now look on the United States as having at least one representative, I hope more, but at least one, who understands their problem, who speaks their language, who will listen to them when they put forward their woes and their hopes for the future. I think we have a new sense in the minds of those kinds of people of caring about them. And to a major degree, it's because of their trust in Andy Young. I'm disturbed that after he spent 17 days in Africa, sometimes at some considerable danger to his own self, that a remark about Sweden was a major headline that derived from that entire very fruitful visit on his part to that continent. Andy is concerned also. He pointed out to me in a private meeting this past week that he thought it was time for him to shift his emphasis more toward other developing nations outside of Africa, in Asia and in this hemisphere and so forth. I agree with him on that. But in general, I think that Andy Young has been a superb representative of our country. And I think that his use of the word racism has clouded the issue and has brought perhaps undeserved criticism on himself.
Yes, sir.
You've taken a pretty strong position on double dipping. Yes. I want to ask a question about single dipping. How do you justify a system under which 1.5 million government workers retire, take full-time jobs and draw full pensions, where 30 million Social Security retirees, if they work, don't get any pension?
I don't try to justify it. I don't think it's right, and I don't think it's fair. We've had two meetings recently concerning the retirement system and the need for it to be reassessed and perhaps changed. I think there's a wide difference in the retirement benefits that can be expected among Americans who have done the same work as a background and who have contributed widely varying amounts of money into their own retirement systems. I think it's time for a presidential level blue ribbon commission to look at this whole question. The single dipping, the double dipping, triple, sometimes quadruple dipping into retirement benefits. There is another question that's been addressed, at least as far as private retirement systems is concerned, and that's whether or not they are financially sound. Many government retirement programs are unsound, particularly at the local level of government, some at the state level of government. And this is a very dangerous thing for the security of many public servants in our country, presently and in the past. So I think the entire system of retirement needs to be examined very carefully, and although I haven't announced it publicly before, I intend very quickly to appoint a commission to give me advice on what ought to be done to correct these inequities.
Mr. President.
Yes, Marilyn.
On Saturday, you spoke about aggressively, peacefully challenging the Russians in their own spheres. Could you please elaborate on those remarks and explain how this differs, for example, from the Cold War, which in some cases led to hot war, as in Korea and Vietnam?
Yes, the comment that I made was, with an emphasis on peaceful competition, was to win the friendship of nations that in the past have not been close to us, who may have been heavily influenced by or very closely friendly with the Soviet Union, and who may still be. I think this is a normal and a proper hope for our country. We don't want to be in a position that once a country is not friendly to us, and once they are completely within the influence of the Soviet Union, they should forever be in that status. And as I've already indicated and named several countries, Somalia, Ethiopia, Iraq, even more controversial nations like Vietnam, Cuba. I want to move as best I can to reestablish normal, friendly relationships with those countries. In some instances, the obstacles are quite severe, as in the case of Cuba and perhaps Vietnam. But I think this is what our government ought to do. And I would like to have a situation when I go out of office that all the nations in the world have diplomatic relationships with us. We now have 14 who don't. And I've been pursuing this aggressively, to use the word that you described, and also I think that I am completely in the harmony with the Secretary of State and others who work with me on this pursuit. Mr. Moore, I promised.
Mr. President, to follow up on your remarks about human rights, Mrs. Anatoly Sharansky, the wife of a Soviet dissident who's under arrest, is visiting the United States, and yesterday she expressed interest in seeing you to ask you to intervene in this case. I'd like to ask, do you think that this sort of thing can be useful, and do you plan to see her?
I don't have any plans to meet Mrs. Sharansky, but I have inquired deeply within the State Department and within the CIA as to whether or not Mr. Sharansky has ever had any known relationship in a subversive way or otherwise with the CIA. The answer is no. We've double-checked this, and I have been hesitant to make that public announcement, but now I'm completely convinced that contrary to the allegations that have been reported in the press, that Mr. Sharansky has never had any sort of relationship to our knowledge with the CIA.
Mr. President, in the context of your campaign, you said a number of times that the B-1 was an exotic weapon which should not be built. Now you've given two sets of congressmen who met with you last week the impression that even though this is the most expensive plane that would have been built, that you're about to go ahead. Can you comment as to whether you have made a decision and whether you have or not? What leads you to reconsider? What factors make you rethink this compared to what you said in the campaign?
Well, I've not made a decision about what I will do concerning the B-1 bomber. As you know, the Congress, late in 1976, in effect put the B-1 bomber construction in a dormant stage and permitted the expenditure of a certain amount of money per month to build a few B-1 bombers to keep the program alive. I'll make a decision before the end of this month. I've received a great deal of conflicting advice from those who work closely with me, and was eager to meet with one group of members of Congress who were against the B-1 bomber to hear their arguments, and then later met with a group who were for the B-1 bomber, I think the other way around. But they both groups presented their views very strongly and very effectively to me. I think now's the time for me to perhaps on my own and perhaps in a lonely way to make a final judgment. There are major factors involved: the status of our relationship with the Soviet Union on the SALT talks, the quality that we have seen in the latest test of the B-1 bomber, its radar cross-section and the effectiveness of present and future electronic countermeasures, the effectiveness of substitutes for it, the cruise missile being one of those. And in the overall context of our tactical and strategic needs, I'll make a judgment before the end of this month.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you.